Imagine walking into a gym, right? And you have a compound fracture in your leg.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a terrible idea.
Right. You jump on a treadmill because, hey, I mean, treadmills are objectively good for human health. They
Yeah.
build endurance, they strengthen the heart, you know, they push back against ordinary physical decline.
Exactly, for a healthy person.
Yeah, exactly. But because your leg is already broken, jumping on that treadmill doesn't just like fail to help you.
Yeah.
It actively causes permanent catastrophic damage.
You needed an orthopedic surgeon, but you went to a health club.
Yes. And today, in this deep dive, we are looking at a wildly popular relationship tool. Specifically, we're looking at episode one of the marriage course.
Right.
And to get a truly objective view, we ran the transcript of this course through four of the world's most advanced AI analytical models. So
Yeah.
we used Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini, and Grok.
All four of them.
All four. And all four of these independent systems reached the exact same, frankly, chilling conclusion. For the vast majority of couples, this course is a fantastic, highly effective treadmill. But for a specific minority, it is the exact worst thing they could possibly do.
And that tension, I mean, that's what makes this specific analysis so vital.
Yeah.
When we look at a curriculum designed to maintain or improve a relationship, we have to evaluate not just the tools it provides, but the structural assumptions underneath those tools.
Right, because a gym assumes a baseline of functional health.
Exactly. It assumes your bones are intact, your ligaments can bear weight, and you know, your cardiovascular system can handle a stress test. When a marriage enrichment course offers advice, it's making assumptions about the power dynamics, the baseline safety, and really just the goodwill existing in your living room.
Which means our mission today is really twofold. If you are a married couple feeling a bit disconnected, or maybe you're a facilitator tasked with actually guiding a room full of people through this material, we need to completely unpack what this course gets incredibly right.
We really need to explore the psychological mechanics of its best advice.
Right. But we are also going to define the hard boundaries, you know, the red flags, where applying this advice could actually endanger someone.
Yeah, that's so important.
And we'll end with a very specific reality-tested 7-day action plan. But before we get to the AI critiques, we have to establish what the curriculum actually is.
Right, the baseline.
Yeah. What is the fundamental premise that Nikki and Sila Gumbel, they're the hosts of the marriage course, what are they building on in this first episode?
So the foundational thesis of the entire course is that marriage is inherently subject to entropy.
Okay.
It is not a static state of being that you just achieve on your wedding day and then, you know, simply
What,
inhabit.
checking a box?
Right, exactly.
Oh.
It requires deliberate, ongoing, sometimes grueling maintenance to prevent emotional disconnection.
Yeah.
They directly confront the modern, highly consumerist narrative surrounding romantic relationships. You know, that idea that love is primarily an overwhelming
And
feeling.
if you don't feel it, it's over.
Exactly. The moment that feeling evaporates or becomes like difficult to access, the relationship has essentially expired and should just be discarded.
I found their counter-narrative to that consumerist idea really striking, actually. They introduced this concept of winter love.
Oh, yeah. That's a great metaphor.
It is. They tell a story about an author standing on the beach at Carmarthen Bay, talking to a local fisherman. And the author is just going on and on about how stunning the beach is and the summer sun.
Right.
And the grumpy fisherman just barks back, "You should see it in winter."
Wow.
Yeah. And the underlying message, which the course frames as the ocean whispering to the couple, is, "Would you love us in winter?"
That's
It
powerful.
really is. It reframes love from being a passive emotional state that you just kind of endure into an active discipline. It's a choice to persevere through dormant, cold, unyielding seasons.
And the psychology behind that framing is crucial.
How so?
Well, when couples hit a period of profound boredom or stress a winter, the modern instinct is to interpret that discomfort as a signal that the relationship is dead.
Like, oh, we're not happy, so this is broken.
Exactly. But by giving it the label of a season, the course provides couples with a cognitive reframe.
Right, because seasons change.
Yes, a season implies temporary conditions. It implies that a lack of blooming flowers isn't a sign of death. It's a natural biological phase where the roots are actually forced to grow deeper to find water.
Oh, that's a really good way to look at it.
And to operationalize this, they use the overarching metaphor of tending a vineyard, breaking marital maintenance into four specific active phases.
Let's walk through those phases because they pretty much form the entire architecture of the episode.
Right.
The first phase they identify is adjusting. They describe this as the clumsy ongoing transition from independence to interdependence, moving from an I mindset to a we mindset.
Yeah, which is harder than it sounds.
Definitely. But what stood out to me wasn't just the idea of compromising. It was how they addressed the way our perceptions of our partners curdle over time.
Yes. You're referring to the phenomenon of fatal attraction, clinically speaking.
Fatal attraction.
Yeah. The course uses a very grounded anecdote from a couple named Demas and Tiffany to illustrate this.
Okay.
When they first met, Demas was deeply drawn to Tiffany's strong vocal opinions and her intense passion. Like, it was magnetic to him.
Right, that's what he liked about her.
Exactly. But a decade into the marriage, he openly admits on camera that this exact same passion can feel overwhelming, exhausting, and quote-unquote too much to handle.
I want to pause on the mechanics of that. Why does the exact trait that draws us in become the thing we eventually want to change about our spouse? I mean, is it just familiarity breeding contempt?
It's actually a matter of cognitive load and habituation.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, when we are dating, a partner's intense passion or hyperorganization or spontaneity is novel. It provides a dopamine hit because it balances out our own deficits.
Oh, right. Opposites attract.
Exactly. But in the daily grind of sharing a mortgage, raising children, and managing a household, that novelty wears off.
It just becomes everyday life.
Right. The trait no longer registers as exciting. It registers as an obstacle to efficiency or peace.
Wow. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
The adjusting phase in the vineyard metaphor is about accepting that this shift is inevitable. And crucially, it introduces the single most heavily analyzed sentence in the entire episode.
Which is?
I can change myself, but I can't change my partner.
We are definitely going to spend a lot of time on the dark side of that phrase later.
Oh, absolutely.
But in a healthy context, recognizing that you cannot remodel your spouse's core personality is incredibly liberating.
It really is.
It forces the adjustment back onto your own reactions.
Mm.
So if adjusting is the internal work, the second phase, pruning, feels aggressively external.
Yeah, pruning is about the brutal reality of resource allocation.
Okay.
A literal vine will produce terrible grapes if it has too many branches because the root system only has a finite amount of water and nutrients to distribute. A marriage operates on the exact same biological and temporal limits. The course argues that couples must deliberately cut away external competing commitments to protect the energy required for the marriage to survive.
But the way they talk about pruning isn't just about, like, dropping a bowling league.
No, no.
They push this into some very uncomfortable territory, specifically regarding career ambition and even parenting.
Yes, they do.
They argue that the marriage has to take precedence over the children based on the logic that a child's psychological security is derived almost entirely from the stability of the parents' union.
That specific hierarchy, putting the spouse above the children, is a classic tenet of mid-century family systems theory.
Really?
Yeah. The idea is that a child feels safest in a home where the parents are a united, impenetrable front.
Okay, that makes sense.
If the parents sacrifice their connection entirely to become hyper-focused on the children, the foundation of the house rots while the parents are busy decorating the kids' bedrooms.
I see the logic, but I also see why the AI reviewers flag that for further nuance.
Definitely.
We'll get into the exceptions to that rule shortly.
Right.
But the third vineyard phase is supporting.
Right. The analogy here is that a vine cannot stand up under its own weight. It requires a trellis.
Okay.
The course explicitly attacks the myth of the self-sufficient nuclear family. They argue that a marriage requires an external support system, you know, friends, mentors, community.
Yeah.
But internally, supporting means learning to face catastrophic life events as allies rather than as two isolated people living under the same roof.
And they use a heart-wrenching example for this. A couple, Pam and Neil, share their story of going through severe infertility.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
It was. And if you look at the psychological data, unresolved grief like infertility or the loss of a child has a staggering divorce rate attached to it.
It really does.
It destroys couples. Because yeah. Grief is inherently isolating.
It becomes competitive.
Competitive.
When a couple faces profound, non-resolvable trauma, the human brain under stress struggles with empathy. A dynamic forms where one person feels they're suffering more, or the other feels their partner isn't coping correctly.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
The course highlights a pivotal moment where a friend tells Pam, "It is not just your arms that are empty. It is Neil's arms as well."
That completely reframes the entire problem. It forces a shift from my trauma to our shared trauma.
And that shared framing is the trellis.
Right.
The final phase of the vineyard metaphor is renewing.
Okay, renewing.
This acknowledges that a marriage will inevitably accumulate debris. Unspoken resentments, small hurts, invisible walls built brick by brick over years of minor misunderstandings.
And from daily life rubbing together.
Exactly. Renewing is the deliberate, slow process of dismantling those walls and updating your understanding of your partner. Because the person you are married to at 45 is fundamentally different from the person you married at 25.
So the overarching theory is beautiful. You know, adjust your expectations, prune your schedule, support each other through grief, and renew your connection.
Yeah, it sounds great on paper.
But theory doesn't stop couples from fighting in the kitchen over how to load the dishwasher.
Exactly.
How does the course attempt to translate this poetic vineyard metaphor into actual gritty behavioral change?
Well, they prescribe two immediate non-negotiable habits.
Okay.
The first is establishing a regular date night. But they strip away the romanticized Hollywood version of a date. They define it strictly through a logistical triad. Plan, prioritize, and protect.
Right. It doesn't mean dropping $200 on dinner. The focus is entirely on protected attention.
Yes.
You put it on the calendar, you make it immovable, and you physically remove external demands, which usually means putting the phones in another room.
The second habit is shifting from a reactive posture to a proactive posture regarding your partner's emotional needs.
Okay, what does that look like?
Instead of passively waiting for your partner to do something annoying and then reacting to it, you must actively study them to discover what specific actions make them feel loved and then deliberately execute those actions.
You know, I read through that section of the transcript, and I have to admit, my initial reaction was severe skepticism.
Really? Why?
It just sounds incredibly clinical. Like, oh, just schedule a meeting and execute emotional deliverables.
Right, right.
Anyone who has been married for more than a few years knows that when your nervous system is agitated, logic completely evaporates.
Oh, absolutely.
If you are deeply annoyed with your spouse, sitting down for a scheduled date night often just provides a designated time frame to have a really articulate fight.
Yes, that is a very common risk.
So how does the course actually bypass that reality?
This is where Claude's analysis of the episode structure was incredibly illuminating.
Oh.
Claude pointed out that the actual genius of the marriage course isn't the vineyard metaphor. It's the structural engineering of the sessions themselves. The secret weapon is the paused, couple-only conversations.
Tell me more about how that works practically in the room.
Well, throughout the video presentation, the hosts will introduce a concept, and then the video physically pauses. Music plays.
Yeah.
The couples are given a specific, highly structured prompt to discuss privately at their own small table. And the facilitators make an ironclad promise at the beginning of the night. You will never, under any circumstances, be asked to share your relationship details with the wider group.
Oh, so it completely removes the anxiety of group therapy.
Exactly. When couples are in distress, their amygdala, the threat detection center of the brain, is highly active.
Right.
If you put them in a circle and ask them to share their feelings, the threat level spikes and they either shut down or perform a sanitized version of their marriage for the audience.
Yeah, nobody wants to air their dirty laundry to strangers.
Right. But by keeping the disclosure strictly private and by providing a rigid conversational prompt, the course artificially lowers the threat level. It gives couples a safe, bounded container to have a conversation they've likely been avoiding for months.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's pivot to the consensus from our AI reviewers.
Okay.
When Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini, and Grok processed this entire framework, they all highlighted a few specific concepts that they deemed exceptionally valuable for ordinary healthy couples.
Yes, they did.
And the one that universally topped their lists was the distinction between being proactive versus reactive.
They all anchored their praise on a quote featured in the episode from a couple named David and Teresa Ferguson.
Right, I remember this one.
David says, "For the first 15 years, I focused on Teresa's faults and my needs. For the last 15 years, I have focused on my faults and Teresa's needs, and our marriage has been transformed."
I want to dig into the mechanics of why that shift works, because it sounds like a nice bumper sticker, but it actually demands a massive neurological override.
It does. It really does. When you're operating reactively in a relationship, you are locked on a defensive crouch. Your brain is essentially running a background program that scans your environment, which in this case is your partner, for threats, annoyances, or failures to meet your expectations.
You're just looking for reasons to be mad.
Exactly. You are constantly collecting evidence to build a case for why you're aggrieved. This inherently pushes you apart because your partner can feel the scrutiny.
Yeah. Nobody likes being scrutinized.
But by actively deciding to focus on meeting their needs and auditing your own faults, you literally change your own neural pathways.
You stop being an auditor and start being a researcher.
Yes. You start looking for opportunities for connection rather than evidence of failure. And the course illustrates how difficult this is with an incredible story from a couple in Beijing.
Oh, yeah. The one with the physical pain.
Right. The wife suffered from chronic physical pain. Whenever she expressed her pain to her husband, he, operating from a highly logical, problem-solving framework, would tell her to go to the hospital, or he would simply ignore it because he couldn't fix it.
Which infuriated her, because she didn't want a doctor. She wanted comfort.
Exactly. So she eventually sat him down and literally handed him a script.
A literal script.
Yes. She told him, "When I am in pain, I need you to hold me. Repeat my words back to me, validate my feelings, and ask how you can help."
Wow.
He followed the script, and it entirely broke the gridlock in their dynamic.
All the AI reviewers love that anecdote because it destroys the golden rule in marriage.
Yes, it does.
You cannot treat your partner the way you want to be treated. Mm. You have to treat them the way they want to be treated.
Such a profound distinction.
Logic often invalidates emotion. If someone is drowning in emotional overwhelm, throwing a logical solution at them feels like you're throwing a brick at them.
The reviewers also highly praised the course's reality check regarding the pruning phase.
Oh, the lawyer anecdote.
Right. The episode features an anecdote from a high-powered lawyer who was dealing with a massive crisis at work. His wife called him just to connect, and because he was stressed, he was incredibly abrasive and nearly hung up on her.
And the AI critiques noted that this perfectly captures the hypocrisy of the modern professional.
Totally.
We will bend time and space to accommodate a screaming boss. We'll answer emails at midnight. A work emergency always miraculously fits into the schedule.
Always.
But the emotional needs of our spouse are treated like optional side quests. They get pushed to the absolute margins of our time and energy.
Which brings us back to the necessity of the plan, prioritize, protect rule for date nights.
Right.
If you treat your marriage like a residual obligation, you know, something that gets whatever scraps of energy are left over at 10 p.m. on a Friday, the relationship will starve.
Yeah.
Putting it on the calendar forces you to treat your spouse with the same level of professional urgency that you would give to a key client.
And then there's the anti-control principle, which we touched on earlier. I can change myself, but I can't change my partner. Gemini pointed out that this is one of the most empirically durable pieces of psychological wisdom in the entire course.
It forces a couple out of the parent-child dynamic. Mm-hmm. Trying to change your partner is essentially trying to manage their behavior for them.
It's like trying to tailor someone else's suit while they are currently wearing it.
Yes.
You're just poking them with pins. They're getting increasingly irritated. They're squirming around. And at the end of the day, the suit still doesn't fit. You can only tailor your own jacket.
Exactly. Focusing on changing your partner ensures you remain in a cycle of criticize, defend, and escalate. Accepting that you only have agency over your own responses halts that cycle immediately.
So we have this beautiful, time-tested principle, I can only change myself.
Right.
And in a relatively healthy marriage, where both people have goodwill, that principle kills petty arguments dead.
It does.
But as I was reading through the synthesized AI critiques, Claude raised a terrifying counterpoint.
Hmm.
What happens when the behavior you're trying to accept isn't just annoying, but actively dangerous?
And this is where we hit the critical failure point of the curriculum. All four independent models, Claude, ChatGPT, Gemini, and Grok, converged on a massive flashing red warning light regarding the unstated assumptions of this material.
Okay, tell me about that.
The entire framework of the marriage course assumes a baseline of mutual goodwill, honesty, and roughly equal relational power.
It assumes both people are walking into the gym with healthy bones.
Precisely. But that baseline simply does not exist in every home.
Right.
If you take the advice to focus on your own faults and meet your partner's needs and apply it to a marriage characterized by coercive control, narcissism, or abuse, the advice becomes actively destructive.
Break down the mechanics of why that happens. How does good advice become dangerous?
Well, in a dynamic of coercive control, the abuser is constantly cultivating self-blame within the victim.
Okay.
The abuser's primary gaslighting script is, if you just loved me better, if you just anticipated my needs correctly, if you weren't so difficult, I wouldn't have to yell at you or punish you.
Yeah.
So when a beautifully produced curriculum comes along and tells the victim, stop trying to change your partner, focus on your own faults, and proactively meet their emotional needs, it perfectly validates the abuser's psychological warfare.
That is chilling. It essentially provides the abuser with a theological and psychological endorsement of their own control tactic.
It really does.
The victim is told by an authority figure that a better date night or more personal humility is the key to fixing the abuser's conduct.
Claude explicitly noted that encouraging vulnerability and self-critique in a coercive control situation does not generate mutual intimacy. It just provides the exploiting partner with more ammunition to use against the victim.
And that leads directly to another major blind spot identified by the AI consensus. I actually flagged this when I read the transcript myself because it sounded so definitive.
Which part?
The episode features an unnamed marriage expert who claims, and I quote, the key issue in marriages falling apart is not conflict, it's emotional disconnection. They argue that aloneness is what destroys marriages.
Yeah, all the analytical models push back heavily on that assertion.
Oh, really?
Yes. While emotional disconnection is undeniably the silent killer of couples who are slowly drifting apart due to busyness, stating categorically that conflict is not the key issue is a dangerous clinical oversimplification.
Because if a couple is dealing with chronic contempt, extreme volatility, physical intimidation, or financial exploitation, the conflict absolutely is the problem.
Exactly. Telling a couple in a highly volatile, unsafe dynamic that everyone has conflict, don't worry about that, just focus on emotional connection, is wildly irresponsible.
Yeah, that's terrible advice in that context.
It gives a violent or verbally abusive partner a free pass on their explosive behavior. And it pressures the victim to seek tender emotional connection in the middle of a literal minefield. It treats a life-threatening disease like a minor symptom.
Let's establish the explicit safety boundaries.
Yeah.
Based on the AI critiques, where does the default advice of this course fail, and where should a couple immediately stop using this curriculum?
The reviewers outline specific non-negotiable scenarios requiring professional intervention rather than a vineyard metaphor.
Right.
These include active, unmanaged addiction, untreated serious mental illness, continuing and unrepentant infidelity, deep relational trauma that makes physical or emotional intimacy triggering, and any form of severe coercion, manipulation, or abuse.
And we also have to look at the edge cases of their more generalized advice. Earlier, we talked about the rule that you must prioritize your marriage over your children.
Yes.
For a standard healthy family where the kids' soccer schedules are taking over the calendar, that is a necessary corrective to prevent the marriage from becoming purely transactional.
But consider the exceptions that Gemini highlighted. What if you have a child with severe medical needs or profound neurodevelopmental disabilities?
Right.
What if you are a blended family and the new spouse is actually the source of the child's psychological insecurity?
If a curriculum demands a universal hierarchy where the marriage always trumps the children, it can be weaponized.
Exactly.
It can pressure a loving parent to abandon a highly vulnerable child's immediate needs just to placate a demanding or jealous spouse.
Exactly. The concept of winter love is beautiful when you are enduring a stressful year of job loss or a new baby.
Yeah.
But as the review strongly cautioned, the virtue of perseverance must never be used as a spiritual guilt trip to force a victim to stay in a household where they are being abused or exploited. Separation can sometimes be a necessary life-saving boundary, not a failure of discipline.
So hearing all of this, you might be thinking, wow, this course is a minefield.
Yeah.
But we can't scrap it, because for the 90% of couples operating with goodwill, the tools are phenomenal.
They really are.
Which means the burden of safety falls entirely on the people running the course. If you are a local facilitator, maybe you're a pastor, a therapist, or just a volunteer hosting this in your living room, how do you actually use this material without inadvertently hurting someone?
The absolute first step for any responsible facilitator is establishing explicit safety carve-outs before the video even starts playing.
So before it even begins.
Yes. You must state plainly and out loud to the room that this course is enrichment education. It is preventative maintenance. It is not crisis triage, and it is not trauma therapy.
You literally have to look at the couples and say, the advice you're going to hear tonight about focusing on your own faults does not apply if you're experiencing fear, control, or abuse in your relationship.
Exactly.
You have to give people verbal permission to recognize that this tool might be the wrong medicine for their specific injury.
Accompanying that, facilitators must have discrete, highly accessible referral pathways ready. You can't just broadly tell people to seek help.
Right, that's too vague.
You need a curated list of local domestic abuse services, addiction treatment centers, and licensed trauma specialists. And this information needs to be available discreetly, printed on a card in the restrooms or tucked into the back of a workbook so someone can take it without their partner noticing.
That's a great practical tip.
Furthermore, you must never assume that joint couples counseling is the logical next step for every struggling pair. If there is violence, intimidation, or severe power imbalance, joint counseling is clinically contraindicated and highly dangerous. Individual safety assessments must always come first.
Facilitators also have to act as a nuanced filter for the video itself. The hosts on the screen use a lot of universal, sweeping language. The facilitator has to soften those absolutes when they do the intro or outro.
Yes. When the video romanticizes winter love, the facilitator should follow up by clarifying, winter love means fighting through boredom or temporary stress. It does not mean enduring cruelty or staying no matter what the harm.
Right.
When the video claims conflict isn't the issue, you reframe it. Chronic disconnection erodes many marriages, but for some, unresolved toxic conflict is itself the primary emergency that needs addressing.
We also need to talk about the cultural and theological framing.
Oh, yeah.
The course markets itself as being for everyone, regardless of background. But then it relies heavily on the Genesis concept of two becoming one flesh, and it closes the session with a prayer in Jesus' name.
Which is perfectly acceptable for a Christian congregation. But if you are hosting this for a secular community center, a corporate retreat, or a mixed faith group, pretending the material is entirely secular oversells its neutrality and can really alienate your audience.
Claude's analysis suggested that facilitators should just own the faith framework rather than awkwardly tiptoeing around it. Give non-religious couples explicit permission to adapt or skip the closing prayer without feeling scrutinized.
Yes, that's crucial.
And regarding that Genesis concept of one flesh, Gemini made a brilliant sociological point. A facilitator must clarify that one flesh historically and theologically implies profound mutual honor and interdependence. It does not imply the subjugation of one partner, the erasure of individual boundaries, or the loss of autonomy.
Another crucial adaptation facilitators must make is socioeconomic. The course heavily relies on anecdotes from relatively affluent, dual consent, healthy Western marriages.
The classic example is the let's hire a babysitter and go to a nice restaurant date night.
Exactly. But what if a couple is dealing with brutal shift work? What if one partner is an ER nurse working nights and the other is a teacher working days?
That's tough.
What if they are navigating a household with neurodivergence, physical disabilities, or severe financial strain where a babysitter is out of the question?
If a facilitator simply repeats the dinner and a movie standard, they are setting those couples up for failure and immense guilt.
Yes.
Facilitators need to actively lower the bar and validate micro-connections. For a couple working opposite shifts, a weekly elaborate date is mathematically impossible.
Right. So you look at them and say a 15-minute shared cup of tea at the kitchen counter before one of you leaves for the night shift counts.
And why does it count?
Because the brain's attachment circuitry doesn't register the cost of the meal. It registers eye contact, undivided attention, and physical proximity. That 15 minutes stimulates the same oxytocin release as a two-hour dinner.
And for neurodivergent couples, the course is exercise called Knowing Me, Knowing You, where you are supposed to intuitively guess your partner's emotional needs, might be incredibly frustrating or anxiety-inducing.
Oh, very much so.
A good facilitator will adapt that and encourage direct, literal communication of needs rather than relying on intuitive guessing games. The goal is connection, not mind reading.
Exactly. We have spent a lot of time defining the guardrails. Now we need to actually drive the car.
Let's do it.
If you are listening to this and you are in a safe, cooperative relationship, how do you translate all of this theory into your life by Friday? We promised a concrete plan, so let's walk through a synthesized 7-day experiment drawn directly from the best practices of all 4 AI critiques.
Walk us through the reality of implementing these steps.
This plan is designed to be highly realistic. It requires roughly 10 to 20 minutes a day, culminating in your protected date night.
Okay, day one.
Day one. Schedule and disclose. Your first task is purely logistical. Sit down with your calendars and lock in a specific, immovable time window for date night this week.
You must write it down.
Yes. The psychology of writing it down removes the cognitive load of trying to find the time later. It makes it a binding contract.
Right.
Then, independently, write down your top three current emotional needs. You can use the list provided in the course journal, things like physical affection, verbal encouragement, practical support, or quiet comfort.
Okay, and then?
Exchange your lists with your partner. The rule here is no debating, no defending. You are just exchanging data.
Okay, day two, prune. You look at the schedule for the week and identify one specific distraction to eliminate in order to protect your shared time.
This is huge.
The reality of modern marriage is that dopamine addiction actively fights against marital connection. Doom scrolling on your phone provides a faster, cheaper dopamine hit than talking to your spouse about their day.
It really does.
You have to actively cut something out. Agree that phones go in a drawer from 8 p.m. to 8:30 p.m.
Perfect. Day three, the support check. This is a targeted 15-minute conversation. One of you names one current stressor you are facing. A difficult client at work, family drama, a financial worry.
Okay.
The listening partner is only allowed to ask one question from a specific menu. Do you want listening, comfort, ideas, practical help, or space?
I want to highlight why that specific menu is so vital. It completely bypasses the fix-it reflex.
Yes.
When a partner vents, our brains perceive their stress as a puzzle to be solved, so we offer logic. But if their brain is in a state of emotional overwhelm, logic registers as invalidation.
Exactly.
Giving them a menu of options forces the listener to pause their own problem-solving reflex and actually meet the emotional need in the moment. No fixing unless they explicitly request ideas.
Day four, proactive action. This is where you utilize the data you gathered on day one. You perform one small concrete action that meets a need on your partner's list.
Nice.
If they list an encouragement, you send them a highly specific text in the middle of the workday recognizing something they handled well. If they elicit affection, you offer a physical embrace when they walk in the door without any expectation of it leading to sex. Small, unpredictable gestures of care produce significant oxytocin spikes.
Day five, season check. You sit down for a quick 10-minute chat and use the vineyard metaphor as a diagnostic tool. Which of the four seasons fits our dynamic best right now? Are we in an adjusting phase because one of us got a promotion? Do we need to prune because we haven't had a quiet evening in a month?
Right.
Naming the season gives you a shared vocabulary. It externalizes the problem so you can tackle it together.
Day six, execution. This is the day you have your protected date night. Remember the rules. Keep the bar realistic for your budget and your energy levels. But the absolute golden rule for this time is no logistics talk for the first 30 minutes.
Oh man, that is so hard to do.
It is.
The temptation to use that uninterrupted time to talk about the kids' pediatrician appointments, the grocery budget, or the broken washing machine is overwhelming. But if you do that, it's not a date. It's a staff meeting.
Exactly.
You have to force yourselves to reconnect as individuals first.
And finally, day seven, review. You take 10 minutes on Sunday to debrief the experiment. What specific action helped you feel connected? What felt incredibly forced, awkward, or unsustainable?
Yeah.
Agree on just one practice you want to keep for the following week. Now, I must offer a crucial caveat to this entire 7-day plan.
What's that?
If at any point during these steps, the exercises surface profound fear, deep contempt, or safety concerns, you must stop the experiment immediately and seek professional help. Success for this week is not defined by identical ratings or a magical absence of disagreement. Success is simply gathering new data about your partner.
It's about movement, not perfection. As you go through this week, we want to leave you with two discussion questions to chew on with your partner. First, where is the phrase, "I can change myself," incredibly freeing for us? And where might it be an excuse for one of us to tolerate a dynamic we shouldn't?
That requires a level of deep honesty that can be uncomfortable, but it is necessary.
Yeah.
And the second question, when you look at the triad of plan, prioritize, protect, which one is your weakest link?
That's a good one.
Do you meticulously plan the date but fail to protect it from your phones? Do you prioritize it in theory but never actually write it on the calendar? Identifying the weak link is the only way to structurally fix it.
This has been a massive, intricate, deep dive into some very heavy material.
Yeah.
To synthesize all of this, the core takeaway from episode one of the marriage course is that marital connection doesn't happen by accident.
Right.
It requires deliberate, biological, and temporal engineering, not just romantic endurance.
And the tools they provide, the structural protection of date nights, the proactive study of your partner's emotional language, the bounded conversations, They are phenomenal mechanisms for that engineering, provided you are applying them in an environment of safety and mutual cooperation.
But I want to end by pushing past the course material for a second. I want to look at the foundational premise that the episode relies on. The idea that aloneness is the ultimate enemy that destroys marriages. The course uses this imagery of an empty space inside of us that desperately needs to be filled by our spouse's love.
It is a very common cultural narrative. The spouse as the ultimate completer of the self.
Right. But think about the psychological crushing weight that puts on one single human being.
It's a lot.
If aloneness is the ultimate enemy, we are essentially expecting our modern spouse to fill a void that historically and sociologically was actually meant to be filled by an entire village.
Exactly.
We demand our partners be our co-parent, our financial advisor, our best friend, our romantic ideal, our therapist, and our spiritual confidant.
Which is an impossible job description for any primate. We are not wired to derive all of our regulatory needs from one single source.
Exactly. And how much unbearable pressure does that put on a weekly date night? If the date night is slightly awkward, or if your spouse is just tired, do we panic and feel completely isolated because we have put all of our emotional eggs in one relational basket?
It's too much pressure.
Maybe the truest way to take the pressure off your marriage isn't just to focus harder on your spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's ensuring you're also building deep, sustaining connections outside of it.
It is taking their trellis analogy to its ultimate logical conclusion. The vine absolutely needs the trellis to survive, but the trellis must be anchored in the wider ground of a community to stay standing.
I love that. So, take the 7-day challenge this week. Put down the phones. Stay deeply curious about the person sitting across from you. But remember that they are just one part of your ecosystem. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, and keep exploring.